everybody, can you hear my voice?
Yes, a little loud, Sam.
Ah, tough shit, you got no choice. So grab a glass and sit back in your chair, 'cause Uncorked is going live to air.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, Dave.
How are you?
I'm well, mate.
A new Uncorked episode and a new format.
It is, yeah. We're using a new format. I know most people are consuming this in their ears only, but now we're recording through StreamYard so we can see each other and play tricks on one another. But Dave, it's been a while since we've done this, so I have to say I'm a little bit nervous.
It has been a while. We've got, yeah, if you've been waiting, I think the last podcast dropped on the Friday of the Whiskey Show. So that's going back to the first weekend of October.
What's your excuse? What the hell happened?
We've got an apology to make, haven't we? Because we have a lost episode.
It'll go up in value in the auction market. Yeah, perfect. We have a lost episode. Yeah.
What happened, Sam?
Well, there's a button over here I need to press record, and we had Isabel Graham Mule and Mark Watt on to talk about packaging and where it's been, where it's going in whiskey, and I fucked up and didn't record it.
And we had a great game as well, if you remember. That was a lot of fun. Oh. The game was just hilarious.
That was so funny, yeah.
So what else has happened? It's been a lot of things going on. We did the virtual whiskey show, and that was, huge thanks to everyone who came along to say hello, take part in our World Series tasting, which was pretty cool. And play along with our really stupid games that we did afternoon tea every day. And we tried to include everybody inside the show and outside the show. So thanks for joining us and playing along with that. Huge thanks to Sukinda and Dawn and her team for really pulling that off so successfully. I think it was a pretty impressive setup that they had there with that all those different booths. I thought that worked really pretty cool. What else has happened? What have you been doing? Oh, last week we launched our rye series, didn't we? That was
a bunch of rye whiskies within boutique. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you might be able to see them just behind me. So that was really cool. As you know, I love rye whiskey, and I've been
most people that hear rye, they think American whiskey, but it wasn't just from the States.
No, we've got four European distilleries. I say the new platform, which you tested rather successfully last week on our bonfire night, or your bonfire night fireside sessions, or my fireside session, actually. I was just there as the hand.
Yeah. Topping it up with the flame with some wood. Yeah, we had a fireside session for Character of Isla. What was it? Bonfire night drams. That was cool. And again, it was using this new platform, which I quite liked. And I think it worked really well. And it actually makes it feel, as strange as these times are, I felt connected to our guests, Charlie McLean and Nick Morgan.
Oh, it was just an awesome evening, just sitting there, whiskey and storytelling around a fire. I mean, it was just that, unbelievable. Yeah, superb evening. Really loved it. What else have I got to tell you? I've got a couple of new books in the house. I know lots of people have been talking about it. Johnny Walker, The Long Stride by Nicholas Morgan, that arrived at my house last night. I can't wait to start. Well, I've already started it. You know I have started. I only read the introduction, but can't wait to start that. And at long last, I managed to get the Malt Whiskey Yearbook in the house. Just one Scottish malt distillery to add to the new distillery list. There you go. Did you know what that was?
Are we starting a trivia game already?
The Bonington Distillery in Edinburgh. That's really, it should have been the first Edinburgh distillery, but it ended up being the second new Edinburgh distillery because construction was delayed by a year because archaeologists found some ruins of a distillery from the 1700s.
Yeah,
so they had to stop. And what else has been cool? What else has happened since our last podcast, since the last lost podcast? The Dave Broom and Arthur Motley.
Oh, the Liquid Antiquarian.
Yes, that's pretty cool, isn't it? That's a series. Better than TV, definitely. Well,
it is. You say cool. Let's be clear. It's fucking nerdy as hell, but it's right up our street. It's such a nerdy program, but it's one of the best things happening online in the world of whiskey right now, for sure.
It's, yeah, absolutely really cool. Okay. So that's what we've been up to. What have you lot been up to? And why are we here today, Sam?
Well, we need to, I mean, obviously we have these rye whiskeys that have just come out. We've been into rye. We've been reading articles really for the last 9 months about the threat to Scotch and what's new world whiskey, and include all from England and France. And, you know, we've released world whiskeys, and our eyes have been on that for a long time, I think, between us, Dave. But now we wanted to look down under.
Aye, the Uncorked Down Under episode. So this is episode 17 or 18, if 17 was lost. And we're going to talk about the Australian whiskey boom. The recent growth of distilleries in Australia is absolutely phenomenal. When I looked through the 2007 Malt Whiskey Yearbook, there were just 5 distilleries listed in it. The whole of Australia and New Zealand, just 5. I know there might have been a few more there. I think on that site that you just showed in there, I thought 54 were listed in last one, but that site there lists 294 distilleries in operation, producing whiskey, gin, vodka, rum, and other spirits. And all of this really stems back to certainly the revival of Australian whiskey to 1992 with Bill Lark and his Lark Distillery in Hobart, Tasmania.
So Tasmania and a boom in Australia, that brings us to both of our guests somehow together, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Shall we introduce our guests?
Yes, please. They'll be here in a sec. How are we going to do this, Dave? You want to verbally introduce them and then we'll bring them in? Or, you know, it's all new. This
is Shall we get a... Wow, that was quick. Look at that. I was going to introduce them one by one. It's like magic. Yeah, right.
See you later. Have a nice afternoon.
So representing Australia all the way from the United States of America is David Vitale, the founder of Starwood Distillery. And representing Australia from the heart of Yorkshire, Dr. Abby Nelson and Christopher Jaume, co-founders of the Cooper King Distillery. And I've got some of your new make spirit here. Sadly, I couldn't find any Starwood whiskey in the house. I'm sure there is. I'm absolutely convinced there is. I just haven't found the hidey hole just yet. Welcome to the Uncorked Whiskey Sessions.
Thank you.
So the first question someone might have watching this is, wait, why are Cooper King here for an Australian episode? So Dave, I assume we'll get there, but that's my first question. What?
Yes, what? Well, there's a little piece of Australia growing in Yorkshire. The Cooper King Distillery has a Tasmanian still here. They've started an English whiskey distillery in the heart of Yorkshire, and the still, they built the distillery on their parents' farm, your parents' farm, I think, Abby, wasn't it? And the still comes from Australia. So that is a little piece of Australia in the heart of the Yorkshire countryside.
Fantastic. If I remember rightly, I think it's the only one outside of Australasia, isn't it? Anyone in the Northern Hemisphere, the only Tassie still. So it's real to see it sat here in rural North Yorkshire. It's awesome.
Well, let's have David too brief, but I got to find out how the fuck that happened.
Oh, do you want that now? I think we've thrown the order out of kilter already.
Dave, is there an order? This is chaos.
This is chaos. It's all chaos. Yeah, it is. This is all chaos. Yeah, well, these are the introductions. We do want to know a little bit more about both of you. So David Vitale was one of our guests at our World Whiskey event way back in Summit, I can't remember which one it was. Way back in World Whiskey Day, wasn't it?
I was going to say it was May, which was just yesterday.
And we all looked like the Muppets, didn't we, that Muppet show, because of all these little windows, hundreds of us there, and we're all little tiny people on another form. I think we can't remember what we were using back then. It wasn't StreamYard, I'm sure, was it?
No, we did Zoom, but that was early doors for that kind of thing in lockdown. We were quick to jump on it. You guys were very brave to come. So, David, thanks again for taking part in that. But
it was a lot of fun. Like that day, and the funny thing was that, you know, there was a series of events. You know, the sun didn't set on World Whiskey Day for 24 hours, right? So I kind of felt like I was going around the world doing Zoom calls with familiar faces. So, you know, we'd go from one thing to the next and say, oh, you again.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
So have we got a little bit about David and Starwood Distillery to talk about, or is David going to tell us himself?
I don't want to talk, Dave. I want the guests to talk. We really haven't done this in a while. I mean, should we warm up? Want to take it from the top? I think we can all talk about this from the beginning, because I don't think Australia, well, certainly more and more people are starting to think of the wider world, the world that drinks Scotch whiskey now makes their own whiskeys. And it's still, for many people, this is new news. You know, for us, it's not. But even for us, let's start at the beginning. And the nerds listening to this probably have some idea of the trends that have gone on around the world. But how did whiskey making in Australia really begin?
Yeah, well, I mean, as Dave mentioned, you know, it really, the modern era really started with Bill Lark in Tasmania, sort of pondering a question: why isn't whiskey made in Australia, given particularly Tasmania, given that the climate and the availability of malt and the good quality water down there would make for a great single malt whiskey. And there was a very good reason why. It was because the legislation was such that, or regulations were such that, you know, the minimum size still, I think, is as big as the still we have now after 13 years of operation. Like, it was a, you know, 5,000 litre still was the smallest size you could have to have a license. And obviously that barrier to entry, you know, if you just want to have a go, is quite high. And so he had the regulation changed from 5,000 to 5 litres. Which
5 litres?
Yeah, 5 litres. Okay. Which all of a sudden meant that you could start on the kitchen bench, which is exactly what he did, and then sort of grow from there. And, you know, to Bill's credit, he has always maintained that a rising tide lifts all boats, you know, and in that way has stimulated and worked at, in fact, a lot of other distilleries, you know, particularly Sullivan's Cove. He claims that the 2014 whiskey was actually from his hands. So I'm going to leave that for McGuire and Bill Lark to sort out. But
this is the Sullivan's Cove that was voted best whiskey in the world of Whiskey Magazine.
In the world 2014, yeah. So you know, he's supported the industry in an immeasurable way, not only by changing that regulation, but by then, you know, helping distilleries get started and you know, being, I think, the biggest advocate for firstly Tasmanian whiskey, because that's his hometown, but like Australian whiskey as a category. And, you know, I learned how to make whiskey at Lark Distillery, and, you know, that's where it all started in 92. So mostly in single malt, and it's a really interesting point you raise. You know, now today I can think of 5 rye whiskies just off the top of my head that aren't, you know, like one in Tasmania, Belgrove, with Peter Bignall and Archie Rose in Sydney. Melbourne has a rye distillery called The Gospel. There's some on the West Coast as well in Perth. So, you know, we're doing ryes. We have, you know, effectively a blended whiskey with Twofold. There's quinoa whiskey. There's whiskey, you know, like with wattle seed. There's a huge range of diversity in the whiskey category in Australia. And that's because our regulations are really broad. I mean, you can shoot a cannon through our regs, like they're just so big, right? Like there's, I think it's one line. It's basically a whiskey is a fermented grain mash that's distilled and spends a minimum of 2 years in wood. That's it. You know, so that really does enable you to like take ideas for a walk and still call it whiskey, which is a lot of fun.
Now, there was an Australian whiskey history long before 1992. Yeah, me and much of my Australian whiskey information has come from 2 sources. An excellent whiskey blog by called Whiskey Impressions by Kate Watts, written way back in November 2016. And this 20-page special from Whiskey Magazine that was printed in April 2017. I think I've got some earlier ones when Sullivan's Cove won it, but it was really quite a small operation. Australia in 2014, wasn't it? Really, wasn't much going on.
Yeah, I mean, we were in year seven at that point of, in year one of sales, so we were relatively new, and I think there was maybe 10 other distilleries that were in operation, let alone selling whiskey at that point in time. And as you point out there, that's the modern history. I mean, wherever you have, you know, we particularly Melbourne, Australia, had a huge gold rush in the late 19th century. Sorry, yeah. 18th century. No, 19th century, I got it right. 1863. And wherever you have miners, you know you're going to be able to sell picks and booze, you know. And so there was quite a flourishing whiskey industry back then, which just so happened to be single malt because malted barley was grown for beer, and that was just the next extension. So we had Genever and malt whiskey, interestingly, in the late 1860s, which, you know, really was, I think, the catalyst for our love of whiskey spelled both ways from around the world in Australia. It was really local product produced that was then kind of shipped around the country. I don't know that a lot of it was exported because it was just so much demand for it.
From what I've read, it was all internal. Yeah,
that's
mostly
right.
Internal. Yeah. And then it was controlled.
Sorry, Dave.
I said then it became more controlled. I went right back to history to take it right back to the first recorded legal distillery in Australia. It goes back to 1793.
There you go.
David, I made you big there. I'm going to go off topic. I made you big because is that a double helix behind you?
Yeah, I do that all the time. No. It's just the light coming in. It's morning here, right? So
it's pretty badass. It's serendipity. I love it. Okay, yeah. Sorry.
So 1793, that's just 5 years. I think the first fleet arrived in January the 27th, 1788. That's when the first fleet, those five prisoner ships, there were two Royal Navies and some supply ships. I said more than seven ships, 11 ships, I think, in total. So 27th of January, 1788, and the first legal distillery was, there's records of it, and it was in, where was it? I've got it written down here somewhere. But yes, 1793, I mean, that's pretty damn cool, isn't it? I mean, that goes in parallel to, you know, Scottish whiskey distilleries, American whiskey distilleries, so that knowledge was all around there. The colony's first distillation regulations came around in the 1820s, which is around the same time as our 1823 Excise Act, which you can watch the full explanation on the
Liquid Antiquarian.
Great. So that really sort of defined whiskey in Europe. So I guess being part of the colonies, it was it must have been transferred across. In that time, yeah, I think sailing from the UK to Australia that took like something like 11 months. Amazing, isn't it? It's absolutely amazing when you look back in the history.
See, Dave's into this shit because he was a shipbuilder, so he really loves the boat. They come out of nowhere. Just so everyone knows, Dave and boats have a long history. All right, what about you two then, Abby and Chris? A doctor, a scientist, and an architect. Why are you on an episode of Uncorked? It's about Australian whiskey.
It's mad.
Why have you got an Australian still in Yorkshire? Go.
So, it was about 7 years ago. I just qualified as an architect. Abs was a scientist, got a PhD. We were living in Leeds in our late 20s. Everyone around us buying houses, having kids, settling down. We didn't really fancy doing that quite then, so disrupted things and quit our hard-earned jobs and bought one-way tickets to Australia with absolutely no plans whatsoever.
We thought it would be a really good idea to go as far away from home as physically possible to think about what we wanted to do with our lives.
We can imagine our poor parents at the time as well thinking, yes, you know, all that further education, all done, they're sorted. Then we jacked it all in. Went across to Australia and basically within a couple of weeks found ourselves in Tasmania. and it was about the same time that Sullivan Cove won the awards, won the first one. And we, friends back home with a whiskey blog, Ben actually, Master and Malt, we were backpacking at the time, feeling quite opportunistic, and said, look, we're living in a estate car 20 minutes away from Sullivan Cove, very glamorous. If you pay our, you know, pay some expenses, buy us lunch, we'll go and visit Sullivan's Cove and the other couple of distilleries on the islands, and we'll write you some blog content. And he absolutely leapt to the chance, said, yeah, go and visit them all, we'll pay your expenses. And luckily, us, there were 8 distilleries on the island. So,
we were suddenly transported from being, you know, backpackers. We were working the orchards at the time and literally earning a cent per apple. So we had no money. It was really hard work. And then all of a sudden, we were driving to these distilleries. Who thought we had been flown in especially from England, you know, to report on the industry, which, you know, for, you know, and they were bringing in head distillers off from the holidays, especially to speak to us. And at this point, we didn't really know that much about whiskey. You know, we both drank it, we loved it, we enjoyed it, but we didn't know really how it was made. So we kind of went on this crash course of learning about whiskey. When we turned up at these distilleries, our cover was immediately blown because we turned up in a old of an estate car that we'd been living in, and we literally had tarpaulin for curtains, you know, and they were like, oh, you've not been flown in business class, have you? We were like, no. But we all of a sudden had access to, you know, this really new up-and-coming industry, really small-scale distilleries. Fantastic people, super passionate, for the most part hadn't really come from an industry background as such, but were making, you know, whiskey that was achieving international acclaim.
Well, we went to, who was it first? We went to, the first distillery we actually visited was Peter Bignall at Bell Grove, who we've got a soft spot in our heart ever since. He's actually been here since the distillery, which is kind of cool. So we visited Peter, again, you know, a rye farmer, grew too much rye, made some whiskey, made his own pot still. But his whiskey was absolutely superb, some really wonderful stuff. And as we did this tour of these distilleries, so every weekend we'd go and visit another distillery and some fantastic people and hear another story, another way in, you know, it was just so inspiring and captivating. And it just got us absolutely hooked, as you can imagine, like being there at the time they'd won this award.
It was a really, you know, from a drinker's perspective, it was just an absolute dream come true to have, you know, this really kind of intimate behind the scenes access with, you know, these kind of people who were making it without a lot of marketing. Well, none of them really had a big marketing budget. There was no smoke and mirrors. It was all really honest and open. Yeah, that's what really struck a chord with us. And there was that genuine connection between the people, the product, and the drinker that we hadn't really experienced before. And it was obviously a time in our lives where we were on the brink of something different, but we didn't know what. We thought about working together, but we had no idea in what capacity that would be. And all of a sudden, we just found this this drink, this spirit that we just had this immediate sort of love for, and we got caught up in the romance of it all, and it just spirals from there. You know, visiting our first two distilleries, we talked about maybe we could set up our own distillery. In England at the time, there was only a few whiskies on the shelf. Obviously, English Whiskey, you know, company had been going for quite a few years. So they had set the foundation in England. But we just thought there's maybe something unique we could kind of bring back from Tasmania and present to England. Just start our own little distillery that would draw upon the things that we'd learned from Australia, the kind of Australian attitude, the Tasmanian way of doing things, and bring a little bit of everything sort of back to the distillery. And that's
you know, figuratively
that we're sitting in now with a window through to the distillery, you know, because obviously we visited lots of cellar doors. So you immediately had that connection between the drink being made and then you sort of drinking it.
Well, there's two things. Also, one thing was the Aussie sort of can-do attitude. I think if we were still in England and we said, we've qualified, we've just quit our jobs, we've bought a whiskey still from the other side of the world, we've never made whiskey, you know, we're going to set up a distillery. You tell anyone that in England and you're not going to get a response. We love being in Australia, Australians there. And it was like, oh, good on you, mate. When's it ready? Like, you know, I'll buy your first bottle. There was no hesitation, no doubt. It was absolutely lovely. And we brought that back and managed to keep that attitude going, which I love. And the other thing which was kind of fascinating was the scale of it as well. I mean, most people over in the UK are used to Scottish distilleries, obviously, and fantastic spirit, fantastic distilleries, but generally on quite a large scale. So when we went, did some training over in Tassie with Bill Lark and Dean at Redlands at the time, we spent a week with them. We were distilling on a 900-litre pot still. You can hug it, you know, it's a slightly taller than me. And to suddenly be mashing in my hand and a very manual process, it really helped us understand the process. And when you're doing it, yeah, it was just making whiskey on a sort of a human scale, which really caught our attention. Oh, so yeah, we didn't say why we've got a Tassie still. So
you said you wanted to figuratively bring back the spirit and blah, 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 but you literally brought back a piece of Tasmania.
Yeah, it made perfect sense to us. There was never really a consideration that we would potentially buy a Scottish still next door. It was just we had to have a Tasmanian still.
And the carrots we learned on the still very similar. It's made by a fantastic steelmaker in Hobart, Nap Lua.
An iconic shape for Tasmanian.
They're short, they're squat, they give really rich, oily spirit coming off. So we sort of ordered that and came home, and essentially the largest souvenir we've ever brought back from anywhere.
How
long did it take to ship?
Took about 6 weeks, but we were a bit not naive, but in the early days. So when we shipped the steel, there's a little inside story, and in that I'd accidentally forgot to get it insured while it was at sea. I thought the steelmaker had insured it. He thought I had, and at the same time, I discovered that there was an Attenborough program talking about the number of shipping containers falling into the ocean. So terrifying.
I think it was the point that we were watching that episode. And with these containers falling off into the sea and their contents just floating around the ocean, that I turned to Chris and said, it is insured, right? And he was like, hi, I'll check that one.
It's now, there it is. It's 900 copper pot sat about 5 meters from us. And we love it.
We, you know, put it together ourselves.
Well, there's another little story there. So this still arrived, whatever, it was about 800 kilos of copper and stainless in a big case. We didn't have any lifting equipment, so we had to get a farmer to come and lift it into the distillery in a box, unpack the whole thing. And I kid you not, and I dug this out for you especially today, I don't know if you can see it, but it's a little blue note that says, hello from Tassie, with a smiley face. This is the sole instructions it came with. Utterly ridiculous.
That's a Tasmanian sense of humour for you, right?
Yeah. We loved it. We loved it. Like, if you can put it together, you've earned the right to fire it up. So.
Yeah, exactly.
That can-do attitude is like, best of luck, John.
So our first two stills were the same, from the same steelmaker, Nap Lua. And it's kind of like almost, early on, they were the incumbent steelmakers. You know, that's who we're here and we work with. Now there's a few, the industry of supplying the distillery industry has flourished as well. So we've got maltsters that are thinking about malted barley from a distilling point of view. We've certainly got, a lot of wine supply businesses that are actually starting to think about, well, what does a distillery need that a winery doesn't? And still makers as well, which is amazing in what, let's call it 30 years nearly, you know, that's been sort of... that it started with. We made some tweaks. So I actually got the stills secondhand from a distillery that was going to set up in a shale coal mine west of New South Wales. It's actually operating now, funnily enough. But the guy that previously owned the distillery, the mine wanted to set up a tourism business because there were a lot of Irish and Scottish people that were mining kerosene effectively. And but he had no idea about how to make whiskey at all. So we picked up those two stills. And, you know, what we were looking for was probably not quite as rich and oily a spirit as what was typically coming from Tasmania for a few reasons. If you wanted that, you could get a Tassie whiskey that could deliver that. But also just wanted a bit more versatility in the spirit as well, like in terms of how it sort of presented as a drink. So we'll talk about that later, I'm sure. But so we actually put a jacket around the neck. And then ran like had some water running through it that we could dial in and dial up and down. So it effectively made the neck telescopic. So if we wanted a Tassie style spirit, we could turn it off, the jacket off. And if we wanted it a little more lighter in style, we could dial up the water flow and create more reflux in the right in the spirit. But I remember that we just got a local plumber to come along to do it, and he sort of like approached the still like it was a bomb, you know, like about. and guys, I've got to tell you, coming from an Italian background, when I told my mother I'm going to like finish my professional career and start making whiskey, she started to cry, you know. and honestly, my wife and I moved to Tasmania. It's like, if you moved to America, I would have understood you're going back to her family, but you're leaving me for no one, was the words that still like echo through my mind. So, you know.
So what made you go and become a whiskey maker then?
It was not that dissimilar to what Abby was saying. Like, I just literally walked through the doors of the Lark Distillery, and, you know, they had a small 500-litre copper pot still in the corner of their tasting room, their cellar door. And the aroma of it, you go a few steps further and there's 300 single malt whiskies behind the bar. And this was in 2005, so well before, you know, the big interest. And actually my first passion was craft beer. I still am passionate about it. It's good reason I'm in the Pacific Northwest of the United States.
So I wondered what that connection was there, yeah.
So it's also where my wife's family comes from. But I kind of looked at whiskey, and growing up for me, whiskey was basically Johnny Walker Black was what my Greek friends' dads drank when they were playing poker. And Shivers Regal was what we gave our accountant for Christmas. That was my world of whiskey growing up. And, you know, we didn't really drink whiskey at home. And so walking into this bar and seeing 300 single malts on the back bar, it was like, these are the craft beers of the whiskey industry, was like my mindset. And I really got fascinated, you know, like got really excited by that. And convinced them to give me a job because I was looking for something new, sort of same sort of thing, quarter life crisis, I guess. And the rest is history. I just fell in love with it and decided to kind of think about how we could really extend what Tasmania had done, which is sort of develop really strong credentials for single malt whiskey into something else, into like, okay, a lot of these whiskies take it up to Scotch whiskey and, you know, can battle it out head to head with single malt Scotch. But for me, it was like, okay, that's great. But what I'd love to do is sort of extend that and just say, well, actually in my sharing cabinet at home, I have Japanese, I've got some rye whiskey, I've got bourbon, I have some peated whiskies, and I want to have a viable alternative to any of those and call it Australian whiskey. And that was... that was the dream.
Well, that brings, I mean, I wonder, you already hinted there, we could talk about a million things right now, but what the spirit tastes like, if there is a style that developed, if you're imitating a Tasmanian style in England, or what the spirit tastes like. But even before that, what's the appetite? What was the appetite when you started having these dreams for local domestic whiskey domestically, for Australian whiskey in Australia?
Well, before Sullivan's Cove won that award in 2014, it was a hard slog.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and most of it was sold effectively as a memento from a trip to Tasmania. Like, it was a tourism adjunct, right? and it was a slow burn, you know. And Bill, you know, we're talking about Bill, but genius. Like, he basically had the cellar door and tasting room, and I think it's still there, right next door to the Hobart Information Centre, which didn't have any restrooms, any bathrooms. So they sort of said, look, do you mind if we send people to you to use the bathroom? He's like, of course.
Absolutely.
So all these people walk in and have the same experience that I had. It's like, where on earth am I? And they'd stop at the bar and then you'd sort of say, do you want a taste? And half an hour later, there'd be their partner walking in going, where have you been? What's going on? I thought you fell in. You know, like, I mean, you know, and they're just there sampling some whiskeys. And so it was very, very difficult early on. And part of that was availability. You know, there was wait lists for some of the single malts. And so it was very, really difficult for retailers, the larger retailers anyway, to kind of support the brands because they'd come in and out. And really, it wasn't only until Starwood arrived, and Helliers Road, I should say, up in the north of Tasmania, that there was an abundance of whiskey available to kind of have a permanent section in a retail store, which then meant that there was somewhere for people to go to discover it. You know, so it was a confluence of a few things. Like, we, you know, ourselves and Helliers Road had whiskey, enough whiskey to sort of range in retail stores. Sullivan's Cove won the award, and the other distilleries were starting to kind of be a bit more, have more commercial quantities. That meant that there was a place for consumers to go in a store and there always be an Australian whiskey to try, you know. So that was kind of an inflection point, I think. It wasn't just us having more whiskey. It wasn't just the award. It was a few things that happened at the same time that made that shift in from specialty whiskey that you know, which was a curiosity on a trip to Tasmania,
yeah,
to something that was more readily, you know, like consumed and available. And you know, even now I think 40% of our business globally comes from within 30 miles of the distillery.
Yeah, but that David, sounds very healthy. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Just saying, yeah, David, some of the stuff you said there, I remember we spoke to, was it Mark Nicholson at Lark, whether he's still there or not, I don't know. But he had described it, which you kind of did there as well, was a cultural cringe for a while. So there was there were some really fantastic Aussie whiskies out there, but generally, yeah, like just sort of a novelty item from a tourist trip to Tassie and not something you'd actively go and hunt down. And yeah, he kind of said once that award had been won, then maybe, I don't know if you'd agree, that there's then, it kind of tables turned and there's a bit of pride then. Oh, hang on a minute, we're producing fantastic stuff.
Oh yeah, we've you know, that was a moment, you know. And the great thing for Starwood was that no one else had any whiskey, so we kept, you know, like, if you want to know, like, I could show you a chart of our sales, and it's like, well, clearly that's when the award happened, because it just jumped up and we've never looked back. And the great, you know, look, the great thing about the industry too is that you've got such a broad spectrum of products at different price points too. So, you know, we're kind of champion because of our scale, and you know, me thinking this needs to be in the sharing cabinet, not the special occasion cabinet, not something that's there to look at, you know. Price is a big consideration in that, you know. And so I think in the UK we're about 50 quid, over here we're $50, and in Australia we're under 100, which kind of puts us at, you know, Belvenie price points or like Woodford Reserve price points, you know. So if you're thinking about trading up from your standard sort of single malts or trading up from your standard bourbons into something else, oh, there you go. Yeah,
speaking of Belvenie, I just thought I'd chuck that up.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a great day. That was a moment. You know, those whiskies to me were like that step up, and I felt like that's where we needed to be as well from a price point of view. So that sort of also stimulated a lot of growth. So it was more availability at a price point that people could kind of try. And then, you know, for example, if they started with Starwood at a 50 quid price point, spending a little bit more money on a scarce Tasmanian whiskey that might be a single cask or something like that was an easier step than just sort of going, what, like, this is a $200 bottle of whiskey, it has no context, you know.
Well, it works, David. I mean, we've got a bottle of yours here, so people coming to the distillery here, we want to try and show off some Australian whiskey and talk about sort of our roots and that's one we always recommend because it's available and affordable. And you try and recommend a Tassie whiskey to anyone in England and you're looking at £250 and you can never get hold of it. So it's
very difficult to get hold of a lot of Australian whiskeys here, isn't it?
Right. You know, I mean, I think I say this a lot. It's like I'd be happy to take the keys to any distillery in Australia making whiskey. Like, such is the quality that's being made, right? Like, that's not the, you know, the quality is never in question. The challenge for the industry at this point is availability. You know, like, it's just so hard to find that, and because of that, either there's a secondary market that inflates the price, or just it costs a lot of money to make a small quantity of whiskey, you know.
Economy of scale, yeah.
There's no way around it.
I went looking for Australian whiskeys in my cabinet and I couldn't find it. They must be here somewhere, but I did find a couple of samples. So I just poured some Lime Burners. So it's a single cask. Most of their stuff was single cask. I think we had a few casks turned up in the UK a little while ago, quite a while ago. I must admit, I haven't seen anything for a long time. But yeah, I just poured this. It's absolutely superb. We've only ever had one Australian whiskey in a boutique-y label. We have some Overeem, and I couldn't find it. So there's your still.
Jane and Casey,
Casey and Jane. Jane was a little upset on the first label. She said, "I look like a fella." Can you put me make me a little bit more feminine? So on the second label, we changed it. Yeah. I was talking to her on another online session with someone the other week. I can't remember when it was or who it was. It's just continuous ones of some whiskey bloke. That's what the Australian guy that's over here, and he was chatting to Jane.
That brings back really fond memories seeing that. We went to visit Casey and Jane, and that was in their garage. The stills used to be in their garage on the sort of suburbs of Hobart. Yeah. I remember going in there and having a chat with them and Wim, the distiller.
She's just starting to distill herself now, isn't she?
Yeah, she is indeed.
A new distillery? Yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. It evades me, but I think her and her husband.
Overeem, it's back in family hands, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, Overeem's back in family hands as well. Yeah. That was that's good to hear as well.
Very good to see. Because we went one of the little bonuses that we had from our tour of the Tasmanian distilleries, but we got to use a bottle of whiskey, kind of for our payment, and we chose a bottle of Overeem, port cask, and we sat drinking it in the back of the estate car. You know, that would be a nice little nightcap on a backpacker's budget to have a bottle of Overeem. And I spent more time nosing that whiskey than I did actually drinking it.
Yeah.
When we were there at the time, obviously they were just on the cusp of the boom because of the award, like you alluded to, David. But it was really lovely to see the whole industry pretty much coming together and supporting each other. And Bill Lark, I think when you meet Bill Lark, he's a friendly person. We'd kind of describe him as the Father Christmas of whiskey because he has so much enthusiasm. He's so friendly and likeable. He doesn't take himself too seriously. He's a proper Aussie. And he spoke so fondly of everybody in the industry as a whole. And he spent a lot of time trying to foster that collaborative kind of community feel, which I think was really instrumental in Tasmania and Australian whiskey really reaching the world.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And that's something that, you know, it was really nice to see. We visited one distillery and they would say, you know, if you like this, you should try this whiskey.
Pause there.
Go visit that distillery.
Did you lose me for a minute? Because everything froze. I wasn't sure.
No, you're all good.
We're all there. Okay.
It's always about you, Dave. No, Abby, I think...
I lost sound and vision for a minute as well.
Yeah, but you're deaf, so it's not me being mean. Dave is hard hearing. But okay, Dave, now we lost you, and now you're... But Abby, that's such a good point. And I think that's so... And I could see you nodding away there as well, Dave. And I know we've spoken about this before, but there is something about that spark of wonder that you mentioned when you go to take a piss and discover this place next door to a visitor center. And then, but also that if the liquid didn't follow through on that promise of that spark of wonder and magic that gets planted, it wouldn't have continued, but it did. Mm. and this spirit of sharing and rising tide and that whole philosophy that made Scotch whiskey work, you know, where a single country can have all these distilleries that have survived centuries. I think that those seeds and that intent has worked from Tasmania through Australia. And I think it's a beautiful thing to see from an outsider's perspective that isn't necessarily happening in every New World whiskey country.
No, and, you know, like it's getting to the point now that a lot of our team, you know, so we scaled up, you know, we're kind of just a smidge under 1 million liters of alcohol a year now, which is pretty exciting. I never thought, you know, like I kind of, Dr. Evilsize said, one day we're going to make 1 million liters, you know. But we scaled up such that, you know, some of our team members have kind of learned at us and with us, and now have gone on to other distilleries, which is a lot of, like, I get a sense of pride. It's sad to see them go, but also a sense of pride that sort of, you know, we're playing that role in the industry too, which is great.
Yeah, you definitely are. I think you were saying earlier about being a pioneer in the States, I know you wouldn't probably pat yourself on the back for that, but your timing's great because of taxation on your tax decisions on Scotch whiskey coming in. But also the appetite is there. Again, that spark of wonder. What? Tasmania? What? Australia? What? Taiwan? And the American appetite for whiskey is not diminishing. So, and the thing, think of all the people who are going to be able to follow on your coattails. It really is an exciting time, I think.
And we're now, just to touch on that, you know, that kind of excitement, we were experiencing that wave in Tasmania. But also, we're starting to experience that wave in England as well. You know, English whiskey's just had its first festival. We're all starting to talk to each other, collaborate, you know, work together. So we're starting to see that wave happening here as well, which is really exciting.
Yeah. So, and is there a single figurehead, or how's that working organically amongst the community of English distillers?
So at the moment, we're all meeting and talking. So we put together an English whiskey map when we got back from Australia, in the kind of spirit of promoting what was out there. And there are 14 of us. There's now 26 on cue. Yeah, there's now 24 of us. I think another 6 we know behind the scenes. So there's no single sort of group yet, but we are all talking and forming and thinking about whether we want to protect anything or how we can come together and how we can work together, which is really exciting. A lot of what David was saying about the early days in Australia, it does feel like we're here. And I know there's been the guys in Norfolk for a lot longer, but with 26 of us producing in different size stills and different grains and ryes and all sorts, it's bloody exciting.
We're at
time.
That sweet spot where we've got a lot of, you know, there's some whiskey on the shelves, not a lot. There's more in maturation, which is just about to come out over the next, you know, 1, 2, 3 years. And then you've got some brand new distilleries which haven't even started making their liquid yet. So we've got a bit of everything.
How well do you know all of your Australian whiskey distilleries?
Oh, boy.
Played the English. Wow. Fun fact, Australia was the world's fourth largest producer in the 1920s. How about that? All down to prohibition in the US, you know, a US distilling. So Australia was a huge distilling, I say huge, but, you know, in world terms, it was a big.
Yeah, it was millions of litres, like literally a mile from where our distillery is now. Like huge. Like if you go past it, it's like, you know, 10 city blocks of like a old site, which is a distillery.
Yeah. Yeah, 1888, it was a distillery called the Federal Distillery. 9 million litres of alcohol per year. Anyway, anadrams. Let's play anadrams. Grab a cork or a bottle and a cork. Oh,
right. That's how you buzz in, people.
Oh, okay.
They're all Australian distilleries, and hopefully they all came out the back of this list here. And here is our first one. Limba Nurse. L-I-M.
Wow, he's already pulled. David.
That'd be Lime Burners.
I gave it away, didn't I, by drinking them. I'm telling you what, Lime Burners. Cask M137 is stunning. Absolutely stunning. So that's how we play it.
All right, I'll keep it score this time, Dave, because some people are very competitive.
Lime Burners, it was indeed. Okay, here is your next one. Echo Sierra. Echo Sierra. Rummage in back to see.
Oh,
he's got it. Yeah, I think David pulled again. Yeah,
this would be Archie Rose.
Aye, aye, aye. Right. Well done. Yeah. Cool. You see it. As soon as someone says it, I see it.
I it very
as soon as you that, say it, you know, I say it.
I did this during the week, and the anagram, like it was Scotch whiskey anagrams, and I was up against an amazing whiskey bar in Melbourne called Whiskey and Ailment, which has 400 whiskeys on the back bar. It's like, I'm like, you know, I'm a sitting duck, so.
Odd memories of that bar.
Oh, yeah. Okay. The ones you can remember. Lovely people, though.
Anagram number 3. Dollar heresy. Dollar
heresy. Oh, I guessed, yeah, go for it.
Hellier's Roads?
Yes, of course, yeah. I'm sure I've got a bottle of 10-year-old somewhere downstairs. Oh, Hellier's Road, it definitely was. That's one of them that you do see a bit over here, isn't it? You do see a little bit of Hellier's Road.
Yeah, I mean, they're Pinot cask, they're Pinot finish, so that's kind of like 10 years plus a couple of, I think it's 9 months finished in a Pinot is amazing, like really, really well balanced. You know, I think that a lot of wine finishes can kind of be over the top, but that's a really well balanced Pinot finish. You know, we age fully in wine, which is a different proposition, but that's one of the best wine finishes in the world, I think.
Okay, you ready for your next one? I don't know how many there are on here. We did it a while ago. Slit Yard Killer. Oh, I like the name of this distillery. I can't remember the answers.
Well, the word is still right there. So, Larch Distillery?
Oh, yes, of course it is distillery. Distillery is in there, yes, of course. Slit Yard Distiller Killer. You won.
I'm on the board!
You're on the board. Is there another one? Of course there is. Unveils Vocals. Unveils Vocals.
Oh.
Yeah, we're going to go Sullivan's Cove.
Of course.
Oh, that's a good call. Yeah, good call. Absolutely.
Well done.
On the board. I'm not, and I wrote them all. What's going wrong? I can't remember any of these bloody things. I'm looking at them going, what? Whiskey Rallied Blithely. Whiskey Rallied Blithely.
Oh, that's too many letters. I'm like,
that's far too many. Is there a...
Distillery's in there, yeah.
Distillery is definitely in there, isn't there? Is that the...
So,
Bell?
Okay. Not Bell.
No, it's not Bell Gray.
We need a K in the distillery now.
There's a K up there in whiskey.
Yeah, so...
Black.
Bakery Hill.
Bakery Hill, yes.
Distillery. Thanks for the clue, David. I wouldn't have had it without you, man. The K is in there.
Man.
Yes.
I'm really, really rubbish at remembering anything that I've written down, aren't I? Drool Bath. Let's start the clock. Drool Bath.
It shouldn't be this hard.
Anagrams are always hard.
Well, there's... Oh, man. I assume these are all the more well-known distilleries, because, I mean, with so many right now in Australia, I don't know if I know... Oh, no.
This should be easy.
I think we're out of time on this one.
No.
Old Hoboken.
Well done.
What do you make everywhere?
You throw a new make around, don't you? Tiny Sand Tiller. Oh, I think I recognise this one. I recognise this one. No, I don't. I thought I had.
I see distillery again.
I want to say Nant, but I don't think they're still around.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It's a gossip. How do we feel about Nant, people?
Lovely place. Was this Australia's Paterson crisis or something?
We visited before any of that kicked off. So they, you know, it was good. It was good whiskey. It was a beautiful distillery. Yeah.
If you don't know what we're talking about, you won't find out here. Google it. We're not going there.
There's lots of controversy on that a little while ago. What, a couple, 3 years ago? Casks not being filled on investors.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, here's your next one.
Wow.
Saw slut incidentally.
That's not awesome.
Wow. Suddenly very distracted.
Saw slut. Saw slut.
I see distillery. Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Scientist and the architect, are you taking notes? I can't tell.
Redlands. Redlands?
No.
Oh, is it?
Oh, it's missing a D, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, it's missing one D, isn't it? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tin, not.
Tin, isn't it? A tin something.
Is it a tin shed? That doesn't work.
That doesn't work. Not enough.
I think that's time, Dave. I
think that is time. I think we. What was it?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Ah, that was a new one.
Lantern. How do you say that in a.
Launceston.
Launceston, because in Cornwall, it's Lantern.
Yeah.
Because they're all in a rush in Cornwall. They're late, so they gotta.
Okay, the next one is Bag Tackle. Or a tackle bag in rugby. We should have put it the other way around as a tackle bag, as in something that you have hit when you're.
I see it. I want to be a good host because we're bottling some of this, aren't we, Dave? Can we talk about that? Oops.
Oops.
I recognize that.
Yeah.
I just slipped out.
I think Black Gates?
Yes.
Black Gates.
Yeah, that sounds. Feasible, yes.
Well, with that correct answer, Chris and Abby, you have just jumped ahead and won our Anadrams. Congratulations.
Yay!
I can't blame any of them at all. Not one. My knowledge is rusty.
I read all our blogs before this chat.
Well, proves we can always, I mean, everything's happening so quickly, even in Scotland, like the old world distilleries, there's new distilleries all the time. We all got, there's a lot to keep track of, but that's only a good time for us as drinkers. And you guys, clearly from both your stories, you're also whiskey drinkers and lovers. You know, you use the analogy, you want a whiskey on your sharing shelf rather than your keep shelf. And you got, you know, you guys, I think, Abby, you were saying about what a pleasure it was to go cellar door to cellar door. As a drinker and a lover of whiskey, it's not just the drink though, it's the stories behind them. I know that's the package that does some of the work as well, and just something that just makes you want to know more about the liquid, things like that. I know Glenmorangie came out with, Dave.
I can see some boutique bottles right behind you, Abby.
You can.
Oh,
yeah,
it's not deliberate brand placement. No. They live in the tasting room, they live here.
Yeah. That's boutique gin, is it?
This is Boutique Gin. It's one we did for Boutique Gin Company. So this is, that's me and Chris on the label with my dad as beekeeper because we use some of the honey in our gin and we use like local lavender.
Aussie cool box.
Yeah. Yeah. That wasn't a rare day off.
Yeah.
A one and only day off.
But all those cues, again, that sparks wonder for me. A label like that, of course, Boutique always sort of sparks wonder, makes you ask questions. But I think this is an absolutely beautiful, simple yet magical sort of package, you know? And I know Glenmorangie came out with Cake recently, and that just makes my mouth water. But that reminds me of a recent release from you, David. So I wonder if we could start talking about flavor and what we're trying to do with the whiskey.
So we, you know, I think... you know, it's a really tough, like, if we go back to 2014, 2015, even when there is curiosity about the whiskies, like, people's reference point really is Scotch, if they're whiskey drinkers, is Scotch or bourbon, predominantly, maybe some Irish whiskey, particularly in Australia back then. And it was just, like, one of the struggles that we had was I didn't want to use any reference points from Scotch whiskey, you know, Scotch, bourbon or Irish whiskey to kind of characterize what we were doing, because instantly, like, we were only ever going to be as good as, you know, or like second best to some of the best in the world, right? And so for us, flavor was always at the forefront of our thinking, was that if we could kind of talk about flavor in you know, having conversations with drinkers, then that would be far more appetizing, A. And B, what we started to see was that there were more curious whiskey drinkers that didn't really understand what Scotch, bourbon or Irish were, that they rarely understood that, you know, we age whiskey in barrels, let alone that, you know, for example, Starwood's using wine barrels to do that. So just kind of making the flip from maker's world into the drinker's world and thinking about it from their perspective, flavor was the easy cue, right, to just talk about, well, what do you get when you drink Starwood? And so that last one's actually quite close to my heart. It's a special release called Dolcetz. It's done in Sicilian style dessert wine, so you can probably join the dots there. We can't call it Marsala because it doesn't come from Sicily, but it's an Australian interpretation of Marsala. It's bloody delicious, you know, like, and really, you know, the great thing about it is it's still got all the hallmarks of Starwood with those juicy wine characteristics, but then on top of that, a bit of Pinot and sweet marshmallow nougat, which is, you know, I grew up with all of those things. So
how about you get a Cooper King? Did the flavor of your whiskey find you, or did you tweak it to try and find a particular flavor?
We had some kind of loose parameters. We knew the style of whiskey that we wanted to make, and it was quite heavily influenced by the whiskey coming out of Australia at the time. You know, Tasmania was using a lot of red wine casks, you know, which Dave has mentioned. So there were smaller casks. We were seeing, you know, mature whiskey at 2, 3, 5 years. So there was a few common themes. You know, we kind of wanted to use the smaller cask for that kind of robust flavor. Obviously, we had the Tasmanian still. So there was a few things that we definitely brought back, including using a brewer's barley rather than a distilling dry. Kind of lower yield in terms of alcohol, but just really, really good flavor. So we kind of knew roughly what we wanted. We wanted a really fruity new make as well. You know, yeah, like to bring that beautiful, like, fruit and green apple notes, that's what we wanted to bring to it. And what actually we found was the spirit was roughly what we wanted, but had changed quite considerably in that, obviously, you can only shape it so much, but ultimately your equipment, how we're making it, the time involved, the climate, all of those different things influenced it. And you can control it, you know, to some extent. Ultimately, you have to work with what you have, you know, in terms of the weather. And we didn't want to temperature control our fermentations. We wanted to use an element of kind of human skill and control in that respect. So we've allowed it to become something slightly different to what we thought. But what we've got is a really awesome new make that's full of character. It's got crazy tropical fruit notes of mango, which coming from a Yorkshire barley is not what we expected.
It does smell really tropical. So we do about a 6-7 day fermentation and no temperature control. The spirit coming out, Dave, if you've got some there, the mango, the pineapple, there's green apple. And when you tell people, like, it's water barley yeast, we're in the middle of Yorkshire and they're taking tropical fruits. And I'm sure that David would agree with us in that we're trying to encourage people to drink whiskey however they want to drink it, rather than saying you must try this meat, you mustn't put water with it. So we're making people essentially kyprenias, so you make fresh lime juice and sugar taken up, and people cannot leave because of the whiskey. So we're definitely captivating people. So yeah,
I think that's like a hallmark of a lot of like modern whiskies, whether it's, you know, so we just up the road we've got Westland here in Seattle, Westwood a bit further down the road in Portland, Oregon. And, you know, I kind of almost feel like new make spirit is so doing such a disservice to what we're actually producing as modern whiskey distillers. It's almost like a barley schnapps, you know, like that's kind of my mindset, is that this is product you can drink straight off the still, you know, cut with water. It doesn't need time in wood to become more of what it is, you know. And that's, you know, that modern mindset, I guess, coming along. And, you know, Jim Swan had a lot to do with that. We didn't use Jim, but certainly at that point in time, I actually had two or three conversations with him. But I think by accident, a lot of what was born out of that early era in Tasmania was exactly what Dr. Swan was talking about, which is, you know, you have a good, clean spirit that you know, that's characterful. You don't necessarily need for it to spend years upon, and great quality barrels, of course. You don't need it to spend years upon years in oak to come out with something that's outstanding.
Yeah, something that can stand, you know, upright on its own and be enjoyed by itself and be proud of it, rather than, oh, no one wants to try this. You know, we'll keep that. We'll chuck it in cast and you can try it when it's ready, you know, outright.
Yeah. And
up to that point, for us, it was almost like the new make was just one element of it. You know, at the time, the conversation was all about ask the wood. You know, that's the important thing. Don't worry about anything up to that point. Whereas in Australia, that, you know, they didn't have the heritage and tradition of you know, kind of that Scotland maybe had to fall back on. So they really had to put everything into producing a good spirit that could stand up on its own. That was the you know, and to champion the different stages of the process and let the flavour of the grain carry through, and not to try and override it or kind of lose that character in the wood. It was very much about working with the spirit and let.
And it's a hard way. Oh, go on, sorry.
So the Australian whiskey history period, there's a gap, isn't there, between, you know, when it died out, the original Australian whiskey history died out. So was there any people left, you know, from that distilling background of whiskey to start the new thing, or was it all brand new?
It was all brand new, to my knowledge. I mean, I met one of the former distillers, or like, you know, basically site managers at the Corio Distillery, which is in Victoria. So you mentioned Federal Distillery.
Yeah.
So Federal Distillery was basically a conglomerate of local distilleries that kind of amalgamated. And then they sought investment from United Distillers Limited in 1922 and set up a distillery called a Corio Distillery in Geelong, which is just south, about 60 miles south of Melbourne. And Corio was one of the biggest producers in Australia right up until the late 80s. But over that period of time, the families involved divested all entirely to United. And by the early 80s, it was evident that the interests of United were probably more aligned to getting Scotch whiskey into Australia than it was to continue to make Australian whiskey. And so it suffered a lack of investment. Towards the end, the spirit wasn't great, but some of the early stuff that was, you know, we were selling more Australian whiskey than anything else in the world for a very long time because it was great whiskey. Yeah. Because
in the 1950s, 70% of the market share was a total whiskey share in category was Australian whiskey. 70% in the 1950s at its peak. But it was, it's being controlled, wasn't it? Being controlled by DCL and Gilby's on the other side, because they started making whiskey as well after the Second World War.
Were also involved. So, you know, it was.
They controlled the market and controlled the quality.
Towards the end, not always, but towards the end, that's what happened. And then tariffs were reduced in Australia. We kind of liberalised our whole economy in the mid-80s, and that was pretty much the end of it. But that was basically a six-year break. So the last spirit came off that still in 1986, and then Bill started in 1999. So if you think about that in the context of the wars in the UK and American Prohibition, it's actually quite a small period of idle time, you know. We've got a really long whiskey making heritage. It's just that it hasn't been the history hasn't continued. And in a weird kind of way, I'm okay. I mean, we're called Starwood. Obviously, we're kind of looking forward, not backwards, in terms of our approach to everything and whiskey making. It's not something that, you know, it was a lesson learned early, I think, also from Tasmania, is that, you know, you can pick up a bottle of Sullivan's Cove and mistake it for Scotch whiskey just in terms of the architecture of the bottle and the label and things like that. And we were pretty intent on making something that said, no, we're modern and some, you know, want to talk about the future of whiskey, not the way it was made in the past, but for example.
Yeah. The cynic in me is saying, hang on, we had a whiskey lock in the 1980s in Scotland, and then we had two Scottish companies based making Scotch whiskey who had control of the whiskey markets in Australia, thinking, let's cheapen the brand, and let's offload Scotch whiskey into we had a market there to destroy and build up, didn't they? So, yes, that's my cynic. It just seems to hang on. Why did the Australian whiskey industry collapse in you know, when we had so much whiskey in Scotland and that whiskey lock? Maybe.
It's not going to happen again, that's for sure. You know, for lots of reasons, I think that, you know, the industry is fiercely independent, you know, which is great. The second is that the consumer is, you know, way more kind of curious than they were back then about, you know, like it's not just a label that's kind of a brand that's attracting people to the product. It's like flavor and diversity is a key part of that. So that's exciting. And I think that's the same everywhere in the world, in fact. You know,
If we go back to that period, everyone was drinking blends back then, not single malt. So, yes, there is a very, very different scene today, and everybody's, you know, much more informed and certainly supporting local distilleries, especially when, you know, they're very, very small and there's very little output coming from some of these Australian distilleries. They're just husband and wife teams. Oh, there's one here.
Yeah.
You've touched upon the you know, some of the like downsides of having a small distillery is the you know, how fast they sell out, you know, when you're making kind of small amounts, and yes, even though they're expensive and that can be a way to stem the demand, you still end up with this period of, you know, a couple of months to wait until the next batch comes out, and whilst that can be good for building demand and it's quite exciting, you know, to be the first to kind of add it to your basket, follow through and get the whiskey that, you know, the very minute that it comes online again. But that's something that we will be having to, you know, kind of overcome or work with when our whiskey release, because we're only laying down a cask a week, which is nothing.
So David, yeah, no. I mean, 1 million litres, we're about, I think, 5,000
liters. Oh, you know, I think we did 20,000, which, you know, for me was like balls deep, right? We're full time. You know what I mean? So you're not far off that. And, you know, you'll get to where you want to be. One of the things that we did, because it did frustrate, you know, as a drinker, it did frustrate me to kind of see these prices go through the roof with some of our limited release stuff, like that there is a ginger beer cask whiskey, so it's aged, you know, finished in a ginger beer barrel. I just saw Teeling released one, which is, you know, imitation's the greatest form of flattery, apparently. we do it by ballot, so it's the same price as all of the other products, and we could charge, you know, anything we wanted for that whiskey, but we just basically say, well, you know, we want to stay true to our ethos of accessible Australian whiskey, then all of a sudden inflating prices for things that people prize is kind of antithetical to that. So ballots been a really effective thing. I think Archie Rose also do ballots for their limited release stuff, which I think at least provides a bit of equity to the process and maintains some fairness to the whole approach.
It does make it accessible, like you said. I mean, had someone approach us recently. We sold a few private casks last year, and we'll sell a few more next year, but a small number. We had someone recently came and approached us and said, oh, I'd like to buy 10 casks, like, today.
For us, it's a huge place, you know, a lot of whiskey for us.
But absolutely not going to happen. What's the point? What's the point of selling all that whiskey into one person who can pay the highest price? And there's potentially hundreds of people who are never going to get to try it. And we want people to try it and experience it and enjoy that spirit and learn about the process from start to finish, from the barley right through to the glass, not just to flog it to one person who could pay the highest price. So completely get what you're getting at. Yeah, it's accessible and fair. It's got to be the way, well, it's the way we're choosing to run the business, and by the same, yeah, same token you are too, I think.
Well, you've clearly got a backbone then and an ambition that is genuine and can fight off even offers like this. I imagine it must be hard, you know, to have to lay down stock before you see a return, wait years. And I think hats off to you guys. And David, you touched on it a second ago, of the colonies leading now or whatever, you know, joke, the Empire Strikes Back. And I don't think we should gloss over that. I know we've touched on a lot of issues and I know we're running out of time, but I can tell you for certain that from a Scottish perspective, from a UK perspective, and I don't include English new distilleries in this, but from the old world, Scotch world is finally looking outward and saying, uh-oh, what can we do to reconsider what we're doing from what everyone else in the world has mirrored back at them? They've taken this tradition of whiskey making and are producing things, yes, maybe flavor-driven or maybe abandoning age statements or different packaging sizes or local, whatever. It goes on, the list goes on and on. And Scotch has been slow to react. But now I think we're finally seeing because, and again, it's on the quality of the liquid across England, across all the New World distilleries of the world, but especially Australia, really leading that charge of saying we can do better with this spirit that we've taken for granted maybe for too long.
Mm. Yeah, I was kind of, you mentioned Glenmorangie's cake, you know, and I thought that's like, you know, a real departure, A, for them, but also Scotch whiskey to kind of talk about whiskey in that kind of language.
Yeah, no Gaelic anywhere on the pot, unless cake is a Gaelic word. I don't know. I should look that up before it
tastes like that. Why did we call it cake? Because I like cake.
But it is a departure. And look, they're facing ridicule for it. And I'm sure you face ridicule for some of, you know, the flavor driven is in some circles, in craft beer, I know for sure, and you're a craft beer guy, is seen as a four letter word. It's sort of, some circles laugh at that, where you have orange pulp or grapefruit, rather than saying the hop type or things like this. Well, again, you have to have the wisdom to sit back and see it from a drinker's perspective. How do we navigate this category without that? We don't have age statements. We don't want to necessarily have numbers dictating it and having that hierarchy that's quite simplified and doesn't actually tell us anything about what we're going to be putting into our bodies. So I embrace it, but it is a controversial area. So again, keep plowing forward because it is, I think, inspiring the thinking around the world of whiskey making.
Thank you.
Let's wrap then. I got to go make the kids dinner. I'm sorry. I love this. No, but we could have gone on much longer. I think we only just really we touched a few topics there that we could have gone longer.
There's so much to talk about. Yeah.
There is so much. But we hope to have you again. I guess we will do a World Whiskey Day again, won't we, Dave, this year?
We will have to do
it. I say this year, I mean next year.
Yeah. Count me in. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was great. over far too quickly. I think we could have worked my way halfway through this bottle at Starwood and stayed on for another 4 hours.
It's a good point, actually. It sort of was over before it began, so maybe you could kind of have like a world whiskey day.
Well, we joked about it on the night, didn't we, Dave, that we could do it every week.
Funnily enough.
And David, it's a pleasure to meet you. I know it's only over Zoom, whatever it is. Abby and I, we lived in Melbourne for a while and came out to visit Starwood in 2014, 2015. I didn't realize that was your first year of sales, but it was cracking. So
that you don't recognize our names because we actually applied for a job at Starwood.
That was an awkward one.
CV kept on record in case a certain opportunity comes up.
You know, you're still on the wait list.
That's brilliant.
Well, thanks for having us on, guys. You know, thanks for giving us opportunity to kind of reminisce and chat about, you know, our kind of Australian whiskey roots. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that Australian kind of can-do attitude.
Absolutely.
And just, you know, then whiskey, it was a lot of fun. It was romantic. It was It was interesting. It was fun. And we've come at it from a drinker's perspective. And we're now on the other side of it. So it still gives us that huge buzz.
I think that's what we forget sometimes in the industry, certainly as whiskey geeks, that we're not everyone is a whiskey geek with a Glencairn and a pipette. You know, most people just drink whiskey because they love it. You know, that's simple as that. And they like splashing Coke in it, or they like splashing ginger ale in it. You know, and they like it as a drink rather than, bloody hell, he does 33,000 litres of whiskey. How do they? Yeah,
but that's when it works, isn't it? I think if you've got distilleries and like us and like David, when you can talk honestly about the ingredients and the process, and you're open and transparent, and you've got all the details, and you're really focused and geeky about that. But at the same time, the spirit tastes fantastic at the end of it. So there's a reason you can geek out. It's worth it. But then also that's, you know, we were saying earlier, like, we take the production seriously, absolutely, but we don't take ourselves, we don't take, you know, the drinking again, mix it into, just enjoy it. It's a drink to enjoy at the end of the day, and you can go into as much detail as you want, and that's the wonder of it. Absolutely fascinating. I'm rambling. If we cut this off,
that's the promotional soundbite we waited 80 minutes for. Thank you.
Sorry.
Awesome. Guys, it's been so nice. And hope to see you again in the flesh, of course. But however it happens, it's really nice spending time with you. Thanks a lot for doing this.
No, thank you.
An
absolute pleasure.
As our first little foray into Australian whiskey, I'm sure we'll be back. Wink, wink.
Yeah. I'm coming to a boutique bottle sometime soon.
And maybe even our first inkling of a hint of some English whiskey, maybe.
Wow, how visionary. Yeah, you must have had to buy those a while ago, Dave. That's so exciting. I love you guys. Thanks a lot. This has been Uncorked. I've been Dr. Whiskey.
And I've been Boutique Dave. Cheers, y'all.
Hey, everybody, can you hear my voice?
Yes, a little loud, Sam.
Ah, tough shit. You got no choice. Grab a glass and sit back in your chair, 'cause Uncorked is going live tonight.